Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Foates, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Mary Carwile, who presents a free workshop, Fear of Flying, Tips and Tales from a Pro. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
I want to welcome you on behalf of the Tattered Cover for coming out tonight. And to hear Mary, who you seem to have a pretty good acquaintance with, talk about the her book, The Fear of Flying, and talk about her experiences. I suspect that most of you probably know this, but in 1999, after a recent divorce and a bout with breast cancer, which resulted in her book Heartstrings and Pink Ribbons, Mary decided to embark on a new career as a flight attendant. Passengers opened up to her and shared their stories about flying. Her book, Heartstrings at 35,000 Feet, is a compilation of those stories. So without further ado, here's Mary Carwile to tell you about them.
Well, just a couple of things before we take off this evening. There's just a couple of things I want to tell you. There are two restrooms. They're located right outside the door here. The emergency exit, if anybody needs it, is right down the stairs and out the front door. I don't think oxygen masks will fall from the ceiling, but you just never know. Pretend, if you will, that you're on an aircraft with me, and we're traveling at 35,000 feet above the Earth. We're traveling at about 500 miles an hour. You are comfortably seated in your seats. I've served you your Coke. You've had your chips. I've picked up your trash. And I'm in the back galley cleaning things up in the bins and putting things away when I notice there's a man walking towards me up the back galley, up the aisle, I'm sorry. And he's got a smile on his face. I'm not overly concerned. Let me just read you the story. It's in my first book, Heartstrings at 35,000 Feet. It was about halfway into our flight, a time to rest for a moment after our second beverage service. Tidying up the galley, I stood with my back to the center aisle. Hearing someone approach, I turned around to see the smile of a middle-aged man. "You don't mind if I stand back here and stretch a bit, do you?" he inquired. "Not at all," I said. "I could sure use a break. Sometimes it's hard to stay seated a long time. I had heart surgery some time ago. I just need to get up and move, stretch my legs, get some circulation flowing again," the man explained. "Actually, these exercise sessions are quite common. Sometimes I laugh when I see people doing elaborate stretching in one of our galleys. People have been warned about sitting too long for fear they'll get a blood clot in their leg and they'll die." Well, that isn't the funny part. It's just that on flights less than an hour in length, I have to wonder if it's really necessary to go through such gyrations. I mean, how many people really get up from their chair in front of the TV every 10 minutes to stretch? But this flight was a long one, and I welcomed his company. "A heart attack?" I asked, assuming that's what he meant by heart surgery. "Actually, no," he started. "I'd been having all kinds of heart-related problems. After many, many tests, I was told by my doctor that my heart was dying. I needed a new heart." "What must it feel like to be told that?" I thought. "A new heart isn't something you go get to the store and purchase." The man continued. "It was awfully scary. I thought of myself and my family first. My wife and my kids were quite afraid and upset, of course. But then it hit me. Somebody has to die in order for me to live. Now there's a sobering thought." "Wow, I'd never really thought of that," I said, rather surprised at myself. "How do you go about finding a heart?" Questions flooded my mind. Does it have to be a certain size or age or blood type? Luckily, the man was comfortable talking about it with me. "Well, they put your name on a list and then you wait. Some people wait and wait and never do find a suitable donor. I was lucky. They found a new heart for me in only months. It meant I was going to live, but somebody else had to die. Some family member was grieving their loss. I didn't know much about him just then, but I knew if I were him, I would want to know all the details. How old was the donor? Were they male or female? Would surgery hurt? The surgery went well. It wasn't bad at all. I was feeling so rotten before surgery. This was really a piece of cake. A piece of cake, I doubted that, but agreed it probably wasn't as bad as he expected it to be. Did you ever want to find out where your new heart came from? I sheepishly asked, really wanting to know. You know, I did. That's the best part of my story. A huge smile crossed his face. Oh, I see, I said. The family can then decide. Oh, I'm sorry. They don't give the recipient the name of the donor, but they do give the name of the recipient to the donor's family. He let that soak in for a minute. Oh, I see, I said. The family can then decide if they want to meet the person that received their loved one's heart. Exactly, he said. Well, did you find out? I asked excitedly. Yes, he paused for a moment. I could see in his face that finding out who gave him a new chance at life was highly significant. After receiving my okay, the hospital gave my name to the donor's family, his wife, actually. I learned that my new heart had once beat in the chest of a 25-year-old. That in itself was exciting since I'm nearing 65. Another huge smile crossed his face. Wow, I exclaimed, you really hit the jackpot there, a young, healthy man's heart. And then sobering thoughts left me regretting my short-sightedness. The realization suddenly hit me. That means there's a family that lost their son, a brother, a friend, a wife, all without this special person in their lives anymore. Such sadness mixed with joy and promise. Did you ever get to meet the donor's family? Oh, yes, it was wonderful, he said. My wife and I drove several hours to get to the home of the widow. When we knocked on the door, my knees were banging together. I was just so nervous. I didn't know how she'd react, and there's nothing to prepare you for a moment like this. I tried to imagine, but really couldn't. This young woman was standing face to face with a stranger, but inside his chest beat her husband's heart. We hugged, and she held her ear on my chest for a long moment. I knew what she was doing. We all shared a glass of iced tea and chatted about what kind of a man her husband was, about how he was killed. Just as we were about to leave, a small boy came out of the bedroom, rubbing his little eyes. This is my son, the woman said. He was a real cutie, about 3 years old. She held him until he woke up completely, and then, just as we were about to say our goodbyes, she whispered something to me. What she said gave me chills and a feeling of being honored. She asked, can my little boy sit on your lap? I want him to hear his daddy's heartbeat. Sobering, huh? That's the kind of stories that are in this book. Those of you who have been on an airplane know that we run into turbulence sometimes. Actually, a lot of times. Particularly if you fly in and out of Denver, Colorado, you have turbulence going over those Rocky Mountains. I'm not so sure that's not why they're called Rocky Mountains. Maybe that's why. And as a flight attendant, I do look at people's faces as they're sitting in their seats and everything's fine until we hit a few bumps. And all of a sudden, the hands go down on the armrests. People's faces tense up. Their whole bodies tense up. They are scared to death. Maybe some of you are like that. I used to be like that myself. And one thing that they all do as well is they have their eyes wide like saucers while they're hanging on, and they're looking at one thing, me, to make sure that I'm not nervous. Well, sometimes I am. Sometimes I am nervous. But I've decided that, well, I haven't decided. This is the truth of the matter is that no matter how hard you hang on to that seat, the armrest of your seat, no matter how tense your body gets, it doesn't do anything to change the turbulence. Not a thing. The turbulence doesn't care. The airplane doesn't care. You're sitting there working yourself up into a frazzle, thinking if you held on really tight, it would change. It doesn't do anything. We are going to go through what we're going to go through. The turbulence will end when it's supposed to end. And I have to add a little aside here that I think is pretty funny. I used to be really afraid to fly. And when I first started, when I was first a flight attendant, when we were taking off, particularly from Denver has a really long rollout. So when you're in the plane and it's kind of going down the runway, I'm thinking to myself, there's 132 people here and some kids maybe. There's bags under their seats. There's bags over their heads. There's bags under the cargo. There's cargo in there as well. And we're rolling. It's just not taking off. We're going and we're going and we're going and we're going. And I find myself kind of going like this next to the door going, why aren't we lifting off here? And I found myself for a while till I caught myself. I found I was trying, if you can imagine this, I was trying to lift myself as lightly as I could off the seat so that I would be really light. It would make the plane lift off easier. How absurd. Till one day I realized I was tense myself and trying to lift myself up off the seat. So the next time we took off, which was another 3 hours later, and we went someplace and came back, I thought, I'm just going to show that airplane. I'm just going to sit right into this seat. So I just sat down really hard in the seat and put myself up. And the bottom line is it doesn't make any difference. The plane's going to roll out the way the plane's going to roll out, no matter how hard or soft I'm sitting on the seat. In my second book, Heartstrings and Pink Ribbons, I have a quote that says, I believe it's, worrying is like a rocking chair. It gives you something to do, but it doesn't get you anywhere. It just doesn't get you anywhere. And we all hit turbulence. We hit turbulence in our lives as well. And the first time I personally hit turbulence in my life, I was had been married about 14 years to my high school sweetheart. We were living up in Winter Park. I had a 6.5-year-old son. And I had another son about to be born in about 6 weeks. My husband left for the weekend telling me he was going someplace, was going to be gone all weekend. I found out the next day he wasn't where he told me he was going, so I knew there was a bit of a surprise in store for me. When he came home on Monday night, about midnight, he informed me that he wanted a divorce. Turbulence. Big turbulence. And I would have given anything had there been an oxygen mask hanging from my ceiling so I could have grabbed it and put it on my face and taken a few deep breaths. I thought I couldn't breathe. But I couldn't fall apart. I had people, albeit little people, depending on me. My oldest son started school just the next morning. I had to find, somewhere in that process, I found strength I didn't know I had to keep going. I had to. Well, I dated somebody for about 5 years, the next 5 years, off and on, and we got married after 5 years. I guess suffice it to say it wasn't the best decision for myself and my children. Not to say it was all turbulence. There was some smooth air along the way some places too, but it was turbulent. I knew I should have maybe not be in that relationship. I stayed in that relationship longer than I probably would have, partly out of embarrassment. I was too embarrassed to say I was divorced. To say I was divorced twice was just more than I could handle at the time, so I stayed married. I was married for the first time for 14 years. I was married the second time for 14 years. Nobody can call me a quitter. I hung in there. But after 14 years, I was separated about maybe 6 or 7 months. I was separated when I came to Denver for my annual mammogram, like I always did. And the technician took a little longer to do my mammogram, and when she left me waiting in the room with my little paper gown, as all of you women know what that's like, I sat there wondering why it was taking so long. When she came back into the room, she was followed by the radiologist himself. Usually just the tech will come in and say, you're fine, you can go now. But the radiologist followed, and I thought, this is not good news. So after some biopsies and an MRI or two, I was told, Mary, you have breast cancer. Another one of those times I would give anything had an oxygen mask fallen from the ceiling and I could have taken a couple deep breaths into it as well. It was a difficult time for me, but I was looking for some smooth air maybe. I was looking for something that would get me through a hard time. I was trying to find a direction in my life, some place to go, something to do. And I can't exactly tell you, somebody suggested, a friend kind of dared me to become a flight attendant. I said, a flight attendant? Are you serious? I hate to fly, and I don't like to be cooped up in those airplanes. There's no way I'm going to be a flight attendant. There's no way. But I applied kind of on a dare, and before I really knew what I was doing, I was in the middle of 6 weeks of really intense flight attendant training. During that time, I asked myself many times, what in the world are you doing? But when I got on the plane the first time, there were several blessings happened during the flight attendant, after I became a flight attendant. And one of them was flat out standing up to your fears and saying, you're not going to get the best of me. I'm going to do this in spite of my fears. I'm just going to do it. And I was scared a few times. You bet I was scared. And I'll share with you some of my fears. Maybe there's some of your fears as well. But I didn't know what all the bings and bongs and noises and bumps and grinds and taking off and all that stuff was. And I think once you find out what's going on, it's not fearful. Like, for example, every time I flew before I was a flight attendant and I would hear those chimes go off, I would think, oh no, the captain's calling to tell us we're going to crash. I don't know why else they would call you. Why would they be dinging those dings in the middle of a flight? Like right away, 10 minutes after we get up in the air, dings. Well, now I'm trained and I know that after 10 minutes, that's the captain saying to us, it's okay to get up now and go to work. That's all it is. If you hear dings in the middle of a flight, that probably means that the person in the back is calling the person in the front to say something like, hey, want to go out for dinner when we get there? Or if it's a double ding and the captain's calling both the front and the back, he's usually calling to say something like, boy, I've had too much coffee. Can you come in and relieve me? I need to have a bathroom break. So once you know that the dings are nothing but us communicating, it's our telephone system, it isn't scary at all. I also would hear all kinds of bangs, and I would look up and think something was falling apart. And now I know that I'm making the bangs. I turn around and slam the cart shut and open the doors and throw the glasses in and It's all things I'm doing myself. So another thing on takeoff, again, the Denver one is such a long rollout, but when you're flying to two places I can think of, San Diego and Orange County, they have noise abatement laws. I don't know if anybody's here from California, but suffice it to say that they don't want to be bothered by the noise. So we have to be quiet. We can't leave till after 6 a.m., before 11 o'clock. We have to leave before 11 o'clock at night so that the noise doesn't bother the people in California. Because of that, when you take off in those two places, the captain revs the engine really hard. I wondered about that. I thought the thing was going to fall off the engines were going to fall off or explode or something. He revs it up really hard, and then you just take off. Like it's almost like popping the clutch in the olden days, and it goes up really high, really fast, and then it levels off, which sounds like you're falling out of the sky. And until I'd sit there myself going, why am I so scared? But I had the same fears everybody has about flying. Once you find out what's causing it, there's no fear. You just look at fear in the face, I guess. Maybe one of the most wonderful parts about my job is being able to listen to people and talk to people. When we're not too busy and I have a chance to sit down next to somebody and find out why they're flying, it makes it all worthwhile. Yes, there are people that are crabby or people that are drinking too much or maybe are crying or are surly with us. But we don't know why. We don't know why they're being that way. And so when I've had a chance to sit down and find out why, well, let me just read you another story that kind of explains this. It's called We Never Know. My fellow flight attendants motioned to me from the back of the plane. That lady in 20F wants to be moved. She doesn't want to sit with that baby, she said to me, her voice reflecting annoyance towards the female passenger. The plane was nearly full, but I knew there were a few empty seats located up front in the plane. It wouldn't be a problem at all to move the woman. Something inside prompted me to avoid taking on the annoyed attitude of the other flight attendant. Leaning over the young man holding his small infant, I said to the anxious-to-move woman, would you like to have a seat up closer to the front of the plane? Her look told me she was a bit embarrassed and didn't want to make a fuss. It also told me she was most relieved to be changing her seat. I'd seen the young family board. They had three children between them. Mom took the two small girls and sat across the aisle from Dad and the new baby. It always warms my heart when I see dads caring for small children. So often that job falls to the mothers. Our society seems to dictate that only mothers have been given the nurturing gene, but I've witnessed way too many occasions proving that's not true at all. When the woman passenger excused herself to exit the row, the young man looked hurt. The baby wasn't even crying. Why does she want to move away from us? He must have wondered. I didn't understand either, but wanting to please, I obliged and walked her forward to row 4. Just before she sat down in her new seat, the woman looked at me with such concern in her eyes. She put one hand up by her mouth so as not to be heard by the passengers nearby. She said, I don't mean to be rude, she whispered. I hope you don't think I'm just awful, wanting to move away from that baby and all. Of course not, I replied, although I didn't really understand why. Do we ever really know why some passengers are angry, sad, excited, frightened? The reasons people choose to fly are as varied as the people themselves. But this woman had an explanation that left me speechless. You see, I just lost my grandbaby. I'm going home to his funeral. I just couldn't sit by that baby. I hope you understand. I had to fight to hold back my own tears. Now it makes sense, I thought. It wasn't that she did not want to be bothered by a crying baby the entire flight, not at all. I rushed back to row 20 to tell the young father. He was moved and grateful. Every time I passed his row during that flight, I saw him looking into his baby's eyes. I know he'll never look at his children the same way he did before that flight. And I've been blessed with this book as well. I won a national award for this book in the inspirational spiritual category. And one of the stories was picked up and published in Chicken Soup for the Military Wives Soul. So the books I kind of say are kind of chicken soupy. And I've had people contact me that have purchased this book. One lady said, your book is so tattered because I take it on every single flight I go because it gives me comfort when I fly, knowing that other people have survived this horrible thing of flying in an airplane. My newest book is Heartstrings and Pink Ribbons. Obviously, it's about breast cancer. I'm an 8-year now breast cancer survivor, and I think most of you are aware of the statistics. 1 in 8 people, women, in our country will get breast cancer in their lifetimes. And if it's not you, it's somebody that you know, a teacher, a friend, someone that you know. In closing tonight, I'd like to read you a story from my latest book, and afterwards I'll be signing books over here. And if anybody has any questions about this book or the first book about flying, I'll try to answer your questions. This one is called Walking the Walk, kind of in honor of October being National Breast Cancer Awareness Month. No matter where I looked, left, right, ahead, or behind, all I could see was pink, a rolling sea of pink. The streets appeared to be ribbons of pink. There were pink balloons, pink ball caps, pink shirts, pink tennis shoes, pink signs, pink, pink, and more pink. In the middle of the race for the cure, I wondered if the woman who had first had the idea to hold a fundraising race to help find cure for breast cancer ever in her wildest dreams envisioned this. It was incredible. I was just 1 year out, 1 year since I'd heard that news about my body. 12 months later, I was feeling wonderful, strong, and a bit guilty. I still had my hair. Many bald heads were visible under those pink hats. I was walking unaided. Many were in wheelchairs being pushed along by a loved one. I was walking strong. Others struggled to keep going. Because of an astute radiologist who thought we should take a closer look, when he read my mammogram, my cancer was found in the early stages. His foresight made a huge difference in my life. I'd had a mastectomy and gotten very ill from the effects of morphine. It took some time till I felt strong again, and nearly a year before all the surgeries were completed, and I felt whole again. It's all the did-nots that I'm grateful for, and I feel a bit guilty about. I did not have chemotherapy. I did not have to endure radiation. I did not lose my hair. I wondered, was I entitled to march along with these other survivors? Had I really earned my place in this march? I struggled with that notion. Had I really had breast cancer? It seems almost silly now. Breast cancer is breast cancer, and no matter what stage it's detected, maybe it can be compared to being just a little bit pregnant. I remember hearing a definition for the word grace as getting something you don't deserve. That fit me to a T. Of course I had had breast cancer. I can proudly stand next to my sisters dressed in pink and some brothers as well. I know that had my breast cancer not been caught early, I too would have walked this walk with my head bald under a pink hat. This is a sisterhood that offers no status. It's a sisterhood that is involuntary, but it's a sisterhood nevertheless. It's elite, but not choosy as to whom it selects as members. Yes, I stand tall next to all my sisters, marching arm in arm, hand in hand, showing the world that we're here and we're showing our color, and our color is pink. As I walk this race, I see signs pinned on the backs of other marchers. I walk in honor of my mother. I walk in honor of my sister, Cindy. I walk in memory of my grandmother, Shirley. I walk in memory of my niece, Donna. That's what was on my back. Donna did not live to walk this walk. She was only 37. She fought hard, but she lost her battle. I walk for her. The sign on my son's back read, I walk for my mom, Mary. Tears streamed down my face, seeing the names, thousands of names, making this disease personal, deadly personal. Today's statistics tell us that 1 in 8 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer. The other 7 women, they are the ones who will know someone with breast cancer. It touches us all. It's a sister, a mother, a teacher, a friend. Do we need to live in fear? Not at all. Just be diligent. Stay on top of the yearly mammograms. Don't be afraid to get that lump looked at. Take control of your own body. Listen to your gut feelings. And if you feel, and if you're told that that lump is nothing to worry about, but your inner self does not agree, get another doctor to check it out for you. We're all terminal, each and every one of us. That's not a fatalistic way of looking at life. It's meant to say embrace life. Each day is precious, and when it's over, no one can go back and have a do-over. Life is not a dress rehearsal. We need to develop simple awareness of our own mortality. Maybe then we can make a difference in this world. Breast cancer changed my life for the better. I can say that without hesitation. I learned lessons I would never have learned, met people who have made a huge impact on my life. I would not change a thing. Yes, I earned my place in the sea of pink. I stand tall with all of you, survivors and loved ones. March on, my sisters, march on. Thanks. For those of you who haven't read this book and those of you who are going to read it, I have three people actually in the audience who have stories in this book. First, my husband Ernie wrote a story from his viewpoint called She's More Than Her Breasts. My son Ross wrote his story. He was with me the day I had my mastectomy, and it tells how he felt about all that. My other son, Cole, isn't here, but he wrote a story as well. And then Vicky, who's sitting in the back row here, there's a story called Gut Feelings, and Vicky followed her gut feelings after she was told over and over again, oh, it's nothing. You know, you're pregnant, it's nothing. You're nursing your baby, oh, it's nothing. And she didn't quit, or she wouldn't be sitting here tonight. Has it been 30 years? 25 years. And I shouldn't give away the end of the story, but part of the story involves her daughter, Carrie, who's sitting, I just met tonight, sitting here. She's the reason she's alive, I think. That's her reason for keeping going. Thanks.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fodum. We have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on October 23rd, 2007.